Time to talk a little Boston sports, and to do that, we welcome back to the program from WBZ, CBS Boston, our friend Michael Hurley. Hello there, Michael. Uh-oh, did we lose Mike? Oh, there he is. There he is.
Oh, we lost. A little drama.
Ooh, that was exciting for a moment there. Listen, I want to pump you up with a little bit from one of my favorite philosophers, something to think about this afternoon. We're all getting older. We're not going to last forever.
It's true. Tuukka Rask is more philosophical than anyone would ever do. I mean, actually, you know, he doesn't get credit for a lot of things, so his philosophy is just kind of in line with all of that. But yeah, kind of a depressing night. The Boston Bruins post-game media session, whatever you call them nowadays, it was quite a downer.
So obviously, a lot of the fingers of blame get pointed at Tuukka Rask, and he's deserving of some of that. But there were a lot more problems than just the goaltender with the Bruins here in postseason.
Yeah, I mean the defense really got exposed as just not, you know, forget about Stanley Cup caliber, not even really, you know, beyond the first round of the playoffs caliber. That the defense that was rolling out there, I mean, Connor Clifton is a fun sixth defenseman, kind of a spunky player, not a top four guy. Jared Tenorti was a waiver pickup in the middle of the year, basically serving as their second most reliable D-man. Matt Grzelcyk giving away two goals last night. Just a atrocious situation on the back end. And even, you know, up front, I think, you know, you had basically offensively nothing at all from your third and fourth lines, and you don't need those guys to carry the offense, but you do need them to contribute something, and it all kind of came together there for the Bruins.
Well, and you wrote about the fact that if there was a window, it may be closed because, among other things, there's just not a lot of defensive talent on this team.
There really isn't, and it's really, you know, multi-layered how they got here, but you know, more recently, you can look to just the Zdeno-Chara decision. Look, Zdeno, we don't want to play you that much. We want to sit you down so Jakub Zboril can play, so Urho Vakanainen can play. And those guys did not. Jeremy Lazone, those three guys are their young left-shot D-men, and they were all bad. You know, like, Zboril played the most out of them, but if you can recite to me anything Jakub Zboril did this year in his 42 games, I would be very impressed, because I couldn't do it myself. So, That is a more recent decision. Just some of the moves they've made through, I mean, prioritizing Kevin Miller on day one of free agency last year. Everyone loves Kevin Miller when he's scary and intimidating people, but he's not a very good defenseman, and he certainly isn't healthy enough to be a reliable player. So the decisions on the back end have really snowballed to the point where you have, you know, and I agree that Torrey Krug at $6.5 million is probably too pricey, but when you look at the money that they've spent on Coyle, DeBrusk, and Miller, over $10 million this year, I would have rather had Torrey Krug at $6.5 million. So the decisions have not been good, and they certainly caught up to him. And I honestly don't know where they go from here. Not to be all doom and gloom, but I don't know that they have the management in place to build it back up just based on what they've done over the last 5 years.
Well, they've got some decisions to make here in the offseason, one of the biggest ones being David Krejci. What do you think is the best path, and what one do you suspect they'll choose?
I would think, you know, considering they've been so reliant on just their top line, once they got, what was it, a month of Taylor Hall with David Krejci, and seeing that David Krejci could still drive a second line that could score and contribute, to me, he's a guy I would still want if I was running the team for that. I would not want him at the $7 million premium that he's made for the past however many years it's been. Geez, it must be like 7 years now. But if he was willing to work for a little bit less, you know, maybe give him the Charlie Coyle $5.5 million. He's certainly better than Charlie Coyle, and could be more important. I think they signed Coyle with the intention of being the second line center. He couldn't even be the third line center this year. They had to move him to wing. So to me, I would try to get Krejci back for a few more years at, you know, a reduced price, and try to, you know, ship Coyle off if possible. Find someone that would want him, because that seems to be a miscalculation on their part. And then, you know, that goes right into the Taylor Hall thing. It's like, do you want Taylor Hall? Oh, not if I don't know who his center is. You know, I'm not going to, you know, dedicate a premium to Taylor Hall if I don't know who's going to be, you know, the playmaking center, because if it's Charlie Coyle, I don't really want Taylor Hall, because it's kind of a waste. So kind of a bit of a mess there in the second line situation for the Bruins.
And do they even know what they have with Taylor Hall, who at times looked like the best deadline pickup in years, and then was largely invisible in the Islanders series?
Absolutely. I mean, he got really eliminated in that Islanders series, and that's, you know, Barry Trotz is an excellent defensive coach, and, you know, that team had just shut down Pittsburgh and Sidney Crosby and all that, so it's not like it was against a bad team or anything, but for sure I think he had set expectations pretty high where everyone wanted to re-sign him at the end of the regular season and even through the Washington series, and then all he scored in this series was an empty netter. He did help Pastrnak score that hat-trick ceiling goal in Game 1, but, you know, to me it's, I think, to Brad Marchand's goal in Game 5, where he gets the puck in the neutral zone and decides he's going to beat everybody and score. We were kind of waiting for Taylor Hall to do that the whole series, and he just never did. So, you know, you can't fault the guy for not being outstanding, I guess. You know, you can't be outstanding all the time. That's why it's called outstanding. But certainly a disappointing series for him, and it does kind of complicate matters because who cares about being good in the regular season, especially this year where you're playing Buffalo a million times, New Jersey and all that, if it doesn't really translate in the second round of the playoffs.
We're talking with Michael Hurley here on Downtown. And then, of course, maybe the biggest question is, what do you do in net? We love Jeremy Swayman up here, of course, as a former Black Bear, but do you feel comfortable putting your future in the hands of a goalie with less than a dozen games of NHL experience?
Right, and I mean, Swayman was unbelievable this year, like just a total breath of fresh air, kind of out of nowhere for most of us. I don't think we were counting on him to, you know, be a name we were saying at all. So to me, that is the best, most positive development of the season, but I'm still not ready to give a young goalie with just 10 games of experience the keys to a franchise if I'm trying to compete for Stanley Cups. And for as long as Bergeron and Marchand and Pastrnak are on the first line, you have to be trying to win Stanley Cups. So to me, you know, for as much as Rask frustrates people, he is an excellent goaltender. I think the city, the region, the area, everybody's in for a very rude awakening once it is time for Tuukka Rask to actually move on. Unless maybe Jeremy Swayman turns out to be a Hall of Famer by chance, which would be, you know, a big break for the Boston Bruins. But to me, I still think it's an ideal scenario where Rask comes back. Again, just like Krejci, he's not earning that $7 million premium that he had been making for 8 years, because he's only going to start 55 games for you. He doesn't do any more than that. So, you know, he doesn't want to move, probably. He has family here. If you can get Tuukka Rask back at $5.5 million, Swayman's costing you less than $1 million, and now you're dedicating only $6.5 million to the goaltender position, whereas you've been dedicating between 8 and 10 for the past 5 years with Rask and Hudobin and then Rask and Halak. You actually end up saving a little bit of money and being in a pretty good spot where Swayman can eventually rise to that starting position. So it is ideal, but that's provided that Rask wants to come back and the Bruins want to have him back. Based on what those two people, or what Rask and the organization, have seemingly been at odds for the past couple weeks, I have no idea if that's the case with either of them.
And another question is Brandon Carlo, can they expect anything of him going forward?
Yeah, I mean, and he is their, you know, youngest. I mean, McAvoy is obviously a stud. But Carlo's development was significant this year, and then, you know, to miss a month with a concussion and suffer another one last week is a really tough spot for him and obviously, but also the team, where he made, you know, something like $2.6 million. He's a restricted free agent, a shutdown defenseman, as we've learned in his absence, is a rather significant piece to have. So it's another challenge. I think they'll be able to figure that out, but again, it's a valuable and expensive position to fill. And given his, you know, anytime someone suffers concussions so close to each other, and he also had an injury in between that they said was not related. I don't know if it was or not, but there's definitely a lot of injuries in a short amount of time for him that does make his, you have to consider it, you know, questionable. Just like, you know, Kevin Miller's been for the past 3 years, you can't rely on that when it's just a reality. So kind of a bleak way to look at things, but and that's kind of part of the job, I guess.
Did some of the shine come off Bruce Cassidy? Because I sure felt like there were times when he got out-coached in this series.
Yeah, I mean, Barry Trotz, to me, is, you know, one of the best coaches in the league, and it showed the experience. I had it earlier. I think this was his 23rd playoff series coaching. It was 100. He's coached 155 playoff games, Barry Trotz has, and he just worked this one extremely well. He let Cassidy do all the, you know, writhing and squirming and everything after the losses, and Trotz just kind of sat back and, you know, I don't know if you saw his press conferences, he'd just check out the stat sheet and be like, yeah, I don't know, you have to talk to him about that. So for sure he got out-coached. I don't know. I don't think that was the case last year. I think Tampa was far superior, but I think he was outcoached in the Stanley Cup final by Craig Berube, who wasn't even a coach prior to that. I mean, that wasn't great either. That was an underachievement 2 years ago. This is less so, but for sure, I think Cassidy takes a hit. I don't think like it's time to run him out of town or anything, but
no.
I think it's a reminder of how difficult and how much it changes in the playoffs, because I do think Cassidy lost his composure with some of that, and that's, I think he got frustrated with Rask, and he let that show and made that become a distraction. And, of course, complaining about the refs is never a good tactic to take to the extent that he did. So long way of answering, yes, I do think he got out-coached this postseason.
Let's move to the Patriots for a little bit. I understand not going hard after Julio Jones with the age and other concerns, but what are their options now? Who's out there as potential wide receiver targets?
I think what you got is what you got. I think you got your Aguilar and your Bourne, and I do think Bourne is going to be good in this offense. I mean, he seems like the type of player who's going to come in and, you know, after a few years in the league and really take a step forward with the Patriots offense. I don't think they'll be adding there. I think really they're going to be a tight end driven offense in terms of the passing game. That's why they got Jonnu Smith and Hunter Henry, who hurt his ankle today, but I would imagine that's just a minor thing. And they're going to run the hell out of the ball. I think, you know, they're not going to try to be a top five offense. They're going to try to be a top 12 offense and a top five defense and see how far that gets them. So, on Julio Jones, it's like the Patriots aren't ever the team that goes out and gets the guy when he's still making $15 million. Like, they want the guy when he's making $5 million, you know, in a reclamation-type situation. So the fact that there was no salary retained or anything from Atlanta explains why the Patriots weren't in on that one.
A little more than 3 months to go. From this vantage point, who's the opening day quarterback?
To me, it's still Cam Newton. He's just the most physically ready for it. And, you know, for all of, like, for me, I look at Mac Jones. He has a lot of physical maturation to do. I don't want to put Mac Jones on the field and have, you know, the Von Millers of the world running at him when he's trying to process defenses and isn't, you know, the most physically built guy. I think he could really benefit, you know, long-term from using this year to slowly come along physically, mentally, and everything, so that when he is on the field, it's a much more simple process for him. So I think Cam Newton, I don't know about up there. I know down here everyone talks about Cam Newton like he can't complete a 5-yard pass. He actually can. He did complete numerous double-digit passes last year. So with some actual offensive weapons, I anticipate the offense will be fine. Again, not, you know, lights out, not all world or anything, but he was really working with an empty cupboard last year. Now I think it's going to be a little bit more of a presentable NFL offense, if you will, with Cam Newton there. And, you know, I don't think he's going to be a Pro Bowler. I don't think, you know, we're back to planning our Super Bowl trips in July, but I think it should be a more viable NFL season, because last year was certainly not.
It's funny how quickly things can turn. You know, a year ago, the Red Sox were an afterthought in the Boston sports scene. They were so unwatchable, and now they're, at least for the time being, the last best hope.
It's true. The Celtics were, you know, the closest team to a championship, and then they went 500 this year as the Red Sox soared back to prominence. So the key is to never listen to people like me when we say who's closest to a championship, because I was not saying the Red Sox in early April.
Well, not many were, and those that were, you know, I think also believe in aliens and in keys sticking to your forehead if you get the vaccine.
Or they were, you know, on the payroll of the Red Sox
that,
in charge of it.
That helps indeed.
Yeah, no, but at the very least, they have been a revelation, Houston Astros games notwithstanding.
Right, right. We'll see if they can turn that around tonight with E-Rod. Michael Hurley, CBS Boston, WBZ. Michael, thanks as always. Good talking with you again. And you be well, and we'll catch up with you very soon.
Always appreciate it. Thank you.